University of Colorado.
Welcome to the President's Innovation Podcast, a special See You on the Air series. I'm Mark Kennedy, President of the University of Colorado. One of the best parts of working at CU is learning about the transformative research, ingenuity, and leadership happening every day on our campuses. The CU community and Colorado abound with innovators who are finding solutions to our greatest societal challenges and breaking through boundaries to explore unimagined frontiers. I hope you find the people and stories we showcase as inspiring as I do. They are a huge part of making CU a world-class university.
While patents and business papers are an important aspect in scientific discovery, it's not until that research is making a positive impact in society that it truly matters. I'm your host, Emily Davies, and today on the President's Innovation Podcast, President Mark Kennedy and I talk with serial entrepreneur Stan Lapidus about his accomplishments and insights on business collaboration in advancing healthcare, from ingenuity to implementation. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Stan. To kick things off, you're known as what some people call a serial entrepreneur. Can you tell us about some of your breakthroughs and any resulting businesses and how they're benefiting the life sciences?
So, thank you. I'm an engineer, and I've told my children I'm an inventor. That helps them understand what engineers do. I've done two things that have become widely used. The first is I invented the modern pap smear. I started a company called Cytic. In my time at the company, we raised, maybe $70 or $80 million. Mm. Ultimately, the company raised a couple of hundred million dollars, was sold for $6 billion years later. And the thing I'm most proud of, there are two things I'm proud of. One is if you look at the mortality curves from cervical cancer, you'll see a bump, a good bump, that's due to our innovation. And the second is our prototypes are at the Smithsonian Museum. The second thing I started, the second company I started in healthcare is called Exact Sciences, and we developed the Cologuard test for early detection of colon cancer.
Yeah.
And for those of you who have had or contemplate having a colonoscopy, this is an equally accurate alternative without colonoscopy. I was in my 40s when I was starting Exact, and I wanted to experience what people had told me was a miserable procedure, so I underwent one, paid it for it out of pocket because I was too young to be in the screening population, and it is a miserable procedure. It's a life-saving procedure, to be clear. It's a miserable procedure, so we worked on ways to get this roughly the same benefit without the misery of bowel prep, without the losing a day of work, the discomfort. It's not painful, but there is discomfort. You're sedated, not anesthetized. And we believe that it's an important improvement. Certainly many more people have been screened for colorectal cancer, which is the number one cause of cancer death in non-smokers, since the test has been commercialized.
You may be the only person that's ever breathed the air of the planet Earth that has voluntarily taken a colonoscopy. Yeah.
Well, this is an example of commitment. You have to be committed to your idea.
That's commitment. Well, you've kind of alluded to this, but which areas of the life sciences are nearest and dearest to your heart and why?
I've worked mostly in diagnostics. I've worked on cancer diagnostics. I've worked primarily in early detection. Early detection of cancer has so far proven to be the single best way of improving cancer outcomes. If you can catch a tumor before it becomes malignant, an early stage tumor versus a late stage tumor, you can cure, you can extend the life in a way that so far has yet to occur for most cancers with surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy if those cancers are caught late.
Right, right. Well, I think we all know people who have been affected by cancer. So yeah, that's wonderful. Well, the University of Colorado is a direct beneficiary of your passion, creativity, and dedication. You serve as an advisor to the CU Innovations Initiative at the CU Anschutz Medical Campus, which we learned yesterday unites industry partners, entrepreneurs, and investors to help CU researchers create biomedical technology that improves quality of life. Kimberly Muller, Executive Director of CU Innovations, discusses innovations underway at CU Anschutz.
Our mission is to develop the next generation of healthcare technologies that are going to disrupt healthcare. And so those technologies can be the new drugs and therapeutics that our faculty are developing, new medical devices, but it can also include technologies that are being developed worldwide for how are we going to redefine care delivery. And we bring those opportunities here and we partner with those companies in order to create new products.
Kimberly stresses the importance of Stan Lapidus' contributions to CU Innovations.
Stan has been one of our biggest advisors at the Anschutz Medical Campus. What Stan does at Anschutz is he partners with our SPARK program. SPARK is a program that we partnered with Stanford 3 years ago. And for all of our faculty, it provides education in innovation and entrepreneurship. It gives them grants. And it gives them access to people like Stan, who have built multi-billion dollar successful companies in healthcare.
Stan, can you tell us a little bit more about your role as an advisor, your involvement with the initiative, and you know what's the scope of your advisory role, and when do you get involved in any given process?
I'm still fairly new to Colorado. My wife and I moved here 4 years ago as the grandparents of two little guys, a two-year-old, a three-year-old. And I connected very early on with Kimberly and with her team at CU Innovations. The things I do, the ways in which I try to be helpful, are evaluate new technologies that come from the faculty, from graduate students, and try to provide some business direction on when to seek funding, how to seek funding, how to prepare a business plan. So sometimes I work with the innovations team on questions of patentability, is it worth an investment on the part of the university? I serve as a judge on what's called the SPARK program. And sometimes I work with individual groups of faculty members as they take their ideas and spin them out into companies. For a physician scientist, who often the publication of a paper is the end of the research, there's still a big transition to go from paper to bedside. The way we do that is through the startup. Sometimes it's through licensing, and CU has been very successful in licensing its inventions, the inventions of faculty members, and sometimes through startups. Startups are best when the faculty person is motivated to do a startup. That's, of course, essential. It's either great fun or a nightmare, and it depends on your mindset, depends on how you think about it. Could be terrible, could be great. But it requires a faculty member to learn to think about the continuum of business and science as part of a single process. I often say that business and science lie on an intellectual continuum. Some people are very comfortable with that, and others less so. The ones that apply to the SPARK program, by and large, are very comfortable with the idea and are eager to learn and eager to see their ideas become real.
It seems like a very powerful collaboration of business, science, research, a huge force.
You must have met with some physicians or scientists that think that you're talking a different language and don't really understand that world beyond the paper, or it's very elusive to them and they maybe don't even have a great interest in that. Is that a common element? And how do you get in past that language difference to see it as a continuum that you just described?
By the time I meet physicians, physician scientists, they've kind of mentally made the transition. So it's a highly selected population. I think broadly, Mark, what you say is exactly so. There's a subset, and those are the people with whom I interact.
And the question is, there's something we need to do to expand that subset, you know, for the inventions that are going on, not advance into reality where it's benefiting people. Because, you know, part of our goal as a university is to make sure that we not just invent things, but we bring them to benefit for the state and the nation and the world.
You're asking a very important question, and it really is, what is the role of the university and the community? Because it's not writing papers. That can't be the role of the university and the community. It has to be more than undergraduate classroom education, though that's, of course, the core mission. And the challenge that is true for all universities is relevance. Relevance is measured along many axes. Another axis is, how do we bring the intellectual ferment of faculty to things that extend life, improve the quality of life, make society more civil, make it a better place. I think programs like Spark, which, if nothing else, excite the curiosity of faculty members, is an important first step. A culture of admiring and respecting the translation from ideas developed on campus to businesses off campus is, I think, an important goal of a university as well. I'm not going to go as far and say these should be criteria for tenure. But patents matter. They matter in many cases as much as patents are business documents, to be clear. Patents matter as much as papers, not for all science, but for certain kinds of science, very often true in life science. I was, still am actually, an adjunct faculty member at MIT. MIT has a strong culture of its most senior faculty from early days being inventors and being founders of companies, as well as being prominent. And the one I would cite that may be known to some of the listeners is Vannevar Bush, who was a brilliant electrical engineer. He's got equations named after him, something famously called the Bush decomposition. He was a science advisor to Franklin Roosevelt, and he was the founder of a number of companies. One of them, Raytheon, is a very large company, which interestingly was founded on a thermostat, of all things.
President Kennedy just interviewed a man named Robert Zoellick, who has a wonderful book out that has a whole chapter on Vannevar Bush. Yeah, so I just learned about him.
We discussed him and what an impact he had, not just on creating Raytheon, but on foreign policy and how technology has always been such a core element of America's foreign policy. So
that's actually a very good insight. That's right. My sense is that the culture that took hold at MIT, which is, at its core an engineering school, it does tremendous science and it has other areas of expertise like economics and so forth. At its core is an engineering school, came from leaders like Bush, who very much thought about how to translate discoveries at universities into products. He's not a product guy. He wasn't a product engineer, but he was a guy who understood the spectrum. At CU, we have such individuals prominently at the university, and their stories are, I think, as much a part of the CU story as its academic programs. I cite particularly Larry Gold, who's an amazing inventor and businessman, faculty member, and an inspiration for many of the people I've met both in Boulder and at Anschutz.
If you walked into our eighth floor atrium, you saw the five Nobel Prize winners.
Yeah.
If you went to the other side of the floor, you'll see our MacArthur Fellows.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so we are honoring, you know, those fabulous scientists we have here. But I think what you're saying is we should find another wall where we list the people like Professor Gold.
Larry should be there, yes.
That have gone beyond the paper, beyond the discovery, into the product that benefits people's lives. It's a fascinating, and I'm just intrigued by once they get to the Spark program and they have that interest in their mind, but one of the things that maybe you ought to think about is how do we get more people into the Spark program and what kind of activities do we need to undergo as a university to encourage it? And part of what you're saying is honor and respect those that have gone that extra step.
Yes. Just like we respect the Nobel Prize winners for their achievements, we should honor and respect those that have gone the full distance from idea to translation into a business that has products and services that affect people's lives. One way to consider doing this is, after all, the Spark stories and the stories of the translation from academia to bedside, to taking care of patients, is a story that can be well told by many faculty here. Men and women who participated in doing so. My observation is there is no forum for them to tell their stories to their peers. These are as much sources of inspiration as MacArthur Fellows and as Nobel Prize winners.
Well, that would be a good focus of this series of podcasts, is to elevate their stories and make sure they are known.
There are tremendous innovators on campus, and it'd be great to have their stories broadly told.
What excites you most about the activity and the work underway at CU Innovations?
I think for me, it's the simple breadth of it. This is a very innovative faculty. I work with a young assistant professor at Boulder, Jerome Fox. He's rethinking how to discover drugs. This is not trivial. This is serious. He's a serious scientist and is starting a company, Think Bioscience. He's racked in his first tranche of funding. His vision is large, and he is fearless. So there are plenty of Jerome Foxes that I've met.
That's great. Well, in a perfect or even not so perfect future, how do you envision CU Innovations continuing to impact human health and the life sciences?
Certainly, the elements to me seem to be funding, because the hardest part of building a company is the very first phase, especially when the core is a faculty member who may be inclined to become part of the startup community but doesn't know where to go. So funding is an essential step. Helping faculty reach fundable milestones. So where government grant funding ends and venture capital begins is kind of a desert. Helping individuals through the desert is of great value. And that's one of the things that the Spark program does, to the extent that you believe that that's been successful. And I think Kim would say we turned $1 million into $20 million, or she has numbers like that in the first two classes of Spark. I think that's a strong proof statement, $20 million of subsequent funding. The second is continuing to build the didactic programs, the teaching programs. We're very fortunate, and I didn't know this when I moved here, to have quite a collection of men and women who've been extraordinarily successful in building science and technology-based businesses, continuing to involve them and thinking through how to best involve them. Is it one-on-one? Is it periodic talks? Getting feedback and finding the optimum is very important. So a didactic program. Colorado is short on investment capital for startups. As you appreciate, venture capital is concentrated in San Francisco, Boston, New York, a little bit in San Diego. This remains an unsolved problem. I see that it's much harder for a faculty member with a good idea, with all the motivation and with a strong business plan, to get his or her story in front of investors who can go the distance with that individual. So that's very important. I don't know how to solve it, but without large-scale capital readily available, it's a problem. Now, a glib answer is, well, get on a plane and go to Boston, and that's what I say all the time, and it'll help you with introductions. But it's actually not as simple as that, because it is not, let's go and do a roadshow and go for 5 days and then lose contact. It is constant contact that's important. So now that the world is more virtual, figuring out how to expose CU and the innovation here to the folks with money who are today, say, in Boston competing for Harvard, MIT, Tufts startups, this would be fertile ground and new ground for them.
And maybe figuring out how to clone you so you can benefit more people with your wisdom.
Well, there are plenty of people with skills here already that I met through the Spark program. Again, people who've started or run successful businesses, who volunteer their time to the university. And I think continuing to find people like that, because the network is probably larger than, I think it's 22 advisors that Spark has, or at least the last time I counted. Let's see if we can make that 50.
President Kennedy, you have a very fun story about how you and Stan met. Can you tell us that story?
Well, I had the opportunity to, in my college years, have a colleague that he and I went around the state of Minnesota convincing folks that John H. Crowther was the best place to get your excess and surplus line insurance at. And so you were an early investor in his company.
Yeah.
And he called me up and said, you really ought to talk to Stan. He's a great guy. He's doing wonderful things. And I did. And then when I called the chancellor at Anschutz, he says, well, Stan's doing great and wonderful stuff here. So Ted Snellgrove is our mutual friend's name, and he, like Stan, is an entrepreneur in the biosciences. And so it's amazing how small the world can become.
Ted's a fabulous entrepreneur. He's been associated with some of the greatest successes in cancer diagnostics, most notably a company called Genomic Health, which developed a test to help women answer the very important question. If they're diagnosed with stage one cancer, they don't have spread to the lymph nodes and they're positive for what are called hormone receptors, should they do chemo or not? And you, I think, all appreciate that chemo can be pretty brutal. So for many, many, many women, because of the genomic health test, they can avoid chemotherapy without the risk of shortening their lives. And so Ted was the, I think he was the chief commercial officer of the company and is something of a historic figure in this corner of medicine.
And it's interesting because as I knew him, he comes from a long line of naval aviators, and he was a naval aviator in the Pacific himself, and he's gone from being a naval aviator to doing all the wonderful things that you just described, and with a son who is also a naval aviator currently, you know, what might the world offer? I want to follow up on just a bit of our conversations, because I've been down the Sand Hill Road and the other places where they're just lined with the venture capitalists. Yeah. But I've also, in prior lives, been involved with trying to garner such financing. And people get a reputation. Individuals get a reputation, and I think institutions can get a reputation. Yes. So I wonder if part of this unlocking this larger access to venture capital is to have organizations like CU Innovations getting a positive reputation with Boston and New York and San Francisco venture capital firms to say, hey, two out of the last three I've gotten out of CU Innovations have been real barn burners for us. You know, I'm going to give this one an extra second look. Is that part of the path we ought to be looking for?
I think that's a great idea. It's an excellent suggestion. I think exposure to what's taking place here, not on a one-off basis, but on a constant basis, can yield the kind of capitalization that has been largely elusive for Colorado startups. It's simply harder if you're in Boulder or in Denver or Colorado Springs to launch a tech business or a medical business than it should be.
Stan, I wanted to ask you, as an entrepreneur, you're constantly coming up with new ideas, some of which, not all of them, can obviously reach fruition. How important is failure in the process, in the entrepreneurial process? What role can that play?
Well, of course, one moves quickly to trite sayings, but they're all true. I think the cliche that I've heard the best that summarizes the experience, the entrepreneurial experience, is good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment. and that means failure. And so I get to be the grumpy old man now. For your listeners, I'm 72. And it's a role I love playing because I think I was a grumpy old man when I was 28. And so part of me is very, let's think about the future, let's explore new ideas, and part of it is, but let's be rigorous about evaluating them and making sure. Nevertheless, I racked up two very large successes, two multi-billion dollar companies, and two failures. And in each case, the failure was a failure of the science to replicate or to be extended. So that's on me. We raised, in one case, we took a company public too early. In another case, we should have leavened the science even more before raising what was a substantial amount of money.
Right.
So certainly being prideful, keeping hubris in check, really important.
Yep.
I'd like to think that in enterprises that have succeeded and failed, early on, I did appreciate the value of bringing in the best possible people I could. And not trying to be the smartest guy in the room, but trying to make sure that in each area of the business, the people that I brought in were more accomplished, more able, and more skilled than I.
It seems like, you know, the process of failing is important in what it teaches one.
That's right.
And if you can register, adapt, and then pivot, it seems like it would be a valuable part of the process.
One of the nice things about the American system of enterprise is it forgives failure. You may know or may not know that Ford Motor Company was Henry Ford's fourth car company. He failed at the first three.
He got kicked out
of one of them. You know, he's a tough man.
Yeah.
But he learned his lessons. I think Steve Jobs' story with Apple One, when he was their CEO at the first time and was viewed as brilliant and disruptive, and the searing experience he had at Next Computer, which failed, and he came back to Apple and built the single most valuable company in America, was an example of learning lessons from failure. But the most important thing, I think, is don't blame others. it rarely is the case that somebody else was responsible for the failure. It's oneself, and one has to look hard at oneself and ask, what can I do better next time?
Right.
And in our system, our American system of enterprise, you do get a second chance. And in fact, you get a third chance.
That's nice. I like second and third chances. Well, what can we expect from you next?
So I'm working with some very interesting companies that have a great deal of potential. I talked earlier about Jerome Fox. I met earlier today with a physician scientist named Floyd Tao. He's a prolific inventor, and I worked in cervical cancer. He did as well. He developed the first commercial HPV test,
right.
True visionary. We were friendly competitors years ago, and it turns out we're now neighbors in Colorado. We live, actually, it's the strangest story of all. We live not far from each other. So he's entered into a partnership with the University of Colorado, the state of Colorado, and actually Colorado State University. The University of Colorado is putting some of its own capital in through innovations to do matching for a grant. And what Floyd is working on is early detection of cancer recurrence. Today, cancer recurrence is monitored by periodic imaging. Once you've been treated with surgery, radiation, chemo, or some combination thereof, the next steps are get a CAT scan or a PET scan, initially every 3 months, then every 6 months. The problem is that by the time a lesion, a bump, a tumor, is large enough to show up in a PET scan, it often augurs a poor outcome.
Yes.
Floyd is looking at tiny amounts of blood from a finger stick that can, he believes, detect recurrence earlier, allowing clinical intervention to take place. Now, this isn't true for all cancers and all stages, but for many cancers, it's true. So he's entered into a partnership with the university. And that partnership, we hope, it's a clinical, so the university is doing the clinical piece, he's doing the invention piece, and if things work out, it'll be a tremendous example of collaboration with a tiny startup, at this case, in this point, it's a one-man startup, and a great university and all its resources, its clinical resources, its scientific resources.
That's very exciting. Well, we've heard today how community involvement truly drives innovation and further science, and how when we work together, the impact is not only multiplied, but it advances more quickly. From your perspective, Stan, what else could be done by CU and the community to make an even greater impact in these areas?
So I'm going to just blue sky a little bit.
Yeah, please.
In the world of silos, medical school, graduate schools of arts and sciences often work well together. Where there is siloing is connections between the business school, and this is a great business school here, and the scientists and engineers and physicians that have the innovation. So there's little dialogue between them. If I were designing undergraduate engineering programs, for example, I would make it clear to young engineers that there is no engineering without an enterprise. It could be a government enterprise, it could be a public enterprise, it could be a startup, it could be a large company, but it's important for that young man or woman to understand the role that their work plays. Companies don't exist to create R&D labs, they exist to deliver products and services, which means you have to understand the economics of products and services. What's a profit? Why do profits exist? How do you plan a business to have losses and then turn profitable and still have investors want to participate in that? Because they don't have to. So the dialogue between business schools in particular and other parts of the university is something I would encourage all universities to do. It's a remarkably siloed world.
President Kennedy, I feel like that might resonate pretty loudly with you. What are your thoughts on
that? Well, I think one of the interesting things that is going on at Boulder is they've built a physical connection between the Leeds Business School and the engineering school. And within that connection, they've also are fostering programs to help that collaborative engagement. And I would tell you that the best opportunities in anything that I've found in life is in the cracks in between.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember in a prior life, I was in retail, and I was asking a finance person at a retailer, I says, where does a retailer really make their money? He responded, it's how well you move from summer to fall, fall to winter, winter to spring. Yeah. And that's just another example of this cracks in between. But trying to be one university and understand more broadly than just your own specific discipline really magnifies your ability to have an impact. And so we need to encourage that as much as we can.
I think that's great. I'm going to amplify my remarks a little bit because I'm an engineer. I focused on engineering. How do we expose undergraduates who are focused on majors that are career majors, science and engineering and math, applied math, helping those young people understand how life may unfold for them? I was an engineering student over 50 years ago. It was 4 years of math with one humanities course per semester. It prepared us not at all for whatever, however our lives unfolded. At the end of 4 years, the one thing you could do was work 4 hours a night at a problem set. That was the thing that you needed to get through. But that's poor preparation for participating in the larger world of delivering products and services that are meaningful. This holds really in science education, and the point you made earlier about scientists that are closed to the broader implications of their work simply shouldn't be. The president of my old engineering school said once as a throwaway comment, which I thought was really quite profound. I had mentioned this thing about 4 years of math and humanities, and he pointed his finger at me and said, you know, the reason we teach humanities is because without it, we'd be a trade school. Mm. And I thought it was a great answer, and it was just right and just true. Part of humanities is understanding the history of mankind, how we get on or don't get on with each other. Another part of it is, after all, we're a cooperative species when we're not a warlike species. So if we're cooperating, how do we cooperate? How do we measure it? What are the benefits that indeed cooperation produces? And that's what businesses are. Take an idea, turn it into a product, deliver it to the public. If the public doesn't buy it, it's useless. Go on to the next idea. If it does, learn lessons and build further. So integrating not the dry, this is double entry bookkeeping and this is what a balance sheet is. That's unimportant and that's technical. That's trade school of business. What is important is understanding how products are born, how they're tested, how they're adopted, and what each of us can do to make at least the physical parts of our life better. The spiritual parts are, of course, different. It's a different set of problems. Can't be, it integrates as well, but problems of climate, problems of pollution, problems of aesthetics, of what's beautiful, what's great urban architecture. These are things that all of us should be exposed to as undergraduates.
Absolutely. The bigger picture.
You thought it was good to have humanities in the mix, but you're saying there is some business entrepreneurial training, education that should also be included in that mix for our engineers and our scientists.
That's right. For me, choosing engineering school over being a history major was a very difficult choice. What I reasoned in the end was I could always read history on my own, but I can't learn engineering on my own. But the point you made, President Kennedy, is that it's really important to ask, what are humanities? It's not just literature and not just history. It's very much about understanding how we behave in the real world. It's civics, it's politics, and it's industry. And these represent a larger whole of what humanities are.
My field within academia is on what I call shapeholders, the political, the regulatory, the media, the activist groups that may have no stake in your enterprise but can shape your opportunities and your risk. And as I look at the business schools across the country, I see some of the best business schools that have almost no education as it relates to that aspect of business. But I maintain that it's the most important part that a CEO is focused on, and it's really where you create sustained value. If you look at, for example, Tesla is the highest market value automotive company in North America, even though it's much smaller in sales, but it's designed to appeal to the political, the regulatory, the media activists. And when Volkswagen decided they wanted to engineer around having to comply with certain standards that the government was imposing on them, they lost $26 billion of value in 2 days by ignoring those very same players. And what you're saying is a similar type of understanding also is beneficial to those in the sciences and engineering as
well. We live in a complex web of relationships. And you're speaking to how public opinion is formed. It's not amorphous. It doesn't happen by itself. It happens because people have visions that they're at which they're effective in communicating. So it's important to study this and understand how that happens.
Whatever inspired you to go on the path that you're on? I mean, at age 14, did you say, I wanted to be a serial entrepreneur and solve people's lives? And
not at all. So my arrival in medicine was later. It was mid-career. For the first 20 years, I was a working electrical engineer. I designed circuits in one part of that career for medical devices, but I had no exposure to the medicine side. For me, it was the nexus of physics and engineering that animated me. I had experience and was called then machine vision. Today, it's artificial intelligence. At 30-something years ago, it was very primitive compared to what it was today. I had started a company called Itran Corporation, that had a modest success. For the effort we put into it, modest wasn't good enough. We did inspection of automobile parts in General Motors, primarily factories, but Ford as well. It was remarkably ungratifying. If you ask me what the metric of success was, it was how many GM factory workers we helped get laid off. You know, not a wonderful metric of success, right? Go home and look yourself in the mirror and say, how'd you contribute? And one of the lessons of that business, which in the end made money for everybody and stuff, so it was good, what we didn't have was a problem, an engineering problem that was replicable from factory to factory, from assembly line to assembly line. So we had to do a lot of custom engineering. That meant that our profits were squeezed. We did not achieve profitability, but we sold the company successfully. And I said to myself, as the sale was unfolding, what do I do next? And I said, well, I like machine vision, something I knew something about. What are problems that are poorly solved for which machine vision might be a solution, for which one solution can be replicated tens of thousands or more times? And very quickly, if you just pose the right question, and then I put three further constraints on it, I wanted markets that were huge. I wanted a value proposition. And in medicine, value is measured in lives saved, money saved, lives saved, better outcomes. And finally, an invention that would be strong enough to withstand assault from other competitors. So three things: market, value proposition, and protectable intellectual property. So having set up those criteria on my search, I quickly stumbled across pap smears. Pap smears, unlike other laboratory tests, are the determination. They're not used as an aid in diagnosis like a blood test is. You're either plus or minus. If you're plus, you go to follow-up. If you're minus and the cancer was missed, you're on your way to a very bad outcome. Hysterectomy, death, long painful treatments. So this is a high-stakes test. Unlike other laboratory tests as well, which are run on high-quality, high-speed automated machines, this was done by looking at cells under a microscope, layers of cells that were covered with blood and with mucus. Very difficult. It's, in fact, an inhuman task. So I thought, with all the arrogance of a 38-year-old engineer, that I could break the back of this problem. We raised a little bit of money, and when it was clear that we were failing, we decided to pivot. We had no choice but to pivot, and came up with a way of making a better pap smear. And that turned out to solve all the problems, that by putting cells in a thin layer, by removing blood and mucus, 20 years later, you can see an epidemiologically significant decline in mortality from cervical cancer. Wow. So a simple device that had a measurable outcome at a public health level. Like, along the way, I really got lit up. I had to learn pathology. I had to learn the jargon of medicine. I had to learn how to think about clinical outcomes. I was a total student. I would go on vacation with medical textbooks. I remember going with medical textbooks and a dictionary, carrying 40 pounds of book with me. Books. Our children were small. And in the mornings, in England, I would go for 4 hours to the library to have some quiet and read and just learn. So for me, it was a two-year, very intense learning experience. And that 2 years opened my eyes to the joy of rethinking problems that others thought were solved, but indeed were solved poorly, doing it in medicine, which just lit me up. As an older guy now, I don't question, did I do something in life that was useful? Have I made a contribution? And I must tell you that many of my high school buddies with whom I stay in touch really do have that. So I think it's very important for each of us when we look back to be able to say that we've done something meaningful. Each of us defines meaningful differently, but it's important that we do that. I wanted to just mention one thing about being a serial entrepreneur. So I'm actually unfit to be a corporate executive. So this is a question of learning lessons and knowing what your limits are. I'm a good startup guy. I'm an inventor. I'm good at galvanizing a team around an idea. I'm good at raising money. The skills that are involved in taking a business to its next level are not mine. And when I realized that about myself, it was liberating. So I've been very happy to spend about 7 years or so on an enterprise, stay involved, not stay involved as board chairman or something. But it's very important for each of us to recognize what our strengths are and to be proud of them, but also to be clear-eyed about our limitations.
It's important. And as I talk about sort of lifelong career advice, it always begins with the end. Think about what you want your grandkids to say about you.
What a wonderful thing. What a great idea.
I'm fascinated by the idea that it was having grandkids in Colorado that got you here, which we're appreciative for. But my guess is once you got here, you probably had sort of another new sort of start at a much later age in life that is appears to have animated you and excited you as well.
So I'm in my 70s, as I mentioned, and what animates me now is working with people who are 38 and in their 20s and 30s and 40s and following their vision, moving off a prescribed path into new areas. And I find that tremendously fulfilling.
Well, this has been a phenomenal conversation. We're very thrilled that you have become associated with the University of Colorado and appreciative of all you've done. And it's benefiting not just the university and the state, but changing people's lives for the better.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Stan Lapidus and President Kennedy, for sharing your stories and entrepreneurial insights on the President's Innovation Podcast. And a big thank you to our listeners of this special episode of See You on the Air.
The See You on the Air podcast is a production of the University of Colorado. To learn more about the University of Colorado's unique four-campus system, please visit our website at cu.edu. Please be sure to review and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. See You on the Air is hosted by Emily Davies, produced by Kathy Buten, and recorded and engineered by me, John Arnold. Email us your questions and suggestions at ontheair@cu.edu. We'll see you on the air next time.
University of Colorado.